Radio City, John Grayson and Rob Ross once again bringing you the world of popular culture, hanging out, doing our thing. And it's a, well, right now, as we speak, it's a lovely afternoon. And how's everything in New York, Rob?
So far, it's pretty good. It was a good week. And although you and I just had, and we should tell our listeners because we are still expanding and growing and evolving with this wonderful little enterprise of ours. You know, to sound like we're in the same room, I wanted to be on an actual microphone and under headphones because I do have podcasting equipment, and yet I still can't get the fucking thing to work properly.
Yes.
But at least we've taken that major step from sounding like we're on a radio show phone call that we get done from the very beginning of us doing this 4 years ago to now being on Skype, so it sounds a lot clearer. But still, we want to bring the integrity and the quality of our program to you at maximum capacity.
Right. So if we weren't technologically incompetent, we would have this whole thing done.
Which is a nice way of saying that I'm a fucking retard.
Oh, not you. Listen, we were both sitting here on the phone going, oh, yeah, okay, try this, now do that. And yeah, so we.
But to be fair, again, to our listeners, I only plugged this in for the first time since I bought it over a year ago.
There you go.
Minutes before you called, so the onus is on me, my friend. Sorry, I can't let you take the fall for this one.
Nah.
I appreciate it. No,
not
but on
at
the
all.
Other hand, it was an absolutely magnificent day in Staten Island. Yesterday, we were besieged by a downpour in the morning. I got up at around, I think, 5 in the morning, just naturally.
Yeah.
And it came down from about 5 o'clock until about 8:30, 9 o'clock. I thought there was going to be massive flooding around. Thought, you know what, the hell with it. Won't go out today. It was burning hot, but last week, after you and I spoke, I finally put in the air conditioner, so we're living like civilized human beings.
Good man.
And today was just absolutely magnificent, and the only thing I'm doing now, aside from our show, is preparing to watch the Mets, hopefully, and I say that in very large block letters, hopefully sweep the Giants in San Francisco after 4 o'clock. So,
good.
That's pretty much it.
Well, at least the Mets are faring better than the Cardinals are. So as we sit here outside of St. Louis, just about 30 miles south, the weather is absolutely stunningly beautiful for this time of year because Tropical Storm Cindy came into our south and it drew all kinds of what normally would be nasty, humid weather. It drew down from Canada the not humid, very cool air. So it's been in the 80s still, but the humidity's really low. It's just, I feel like going outside and having a picnic. So I've got to ask you, over these last 7 days, has there been the opportunity for you to go out and enjoy some, not only some outside time, but some music maybe, or any live anything?
No live music, unfortunately. There's really been nothing here that I've wanted to see. There have been things that I've been invited to, but nothing that really piqued my fancy. But in the going outside realm, I have to walk to and from the subway to work.
Right.
And in that brief time that I get to go out, and you know, you have to go out and walk a bit to get some lunch, I've had the chance to enjoy the sunshine at those times of day. And there have been points when it was really, really beautiful. And you know, that's when I take full advantage of it because, you know, since it is brief, you know, in the morning you're walking to work, you have a sense of purpose. Lunch, you're going somewhere again with a sense of purpose. And on the way home, it's already evening. So most of the day is spent, but it's still no less beautiful.
Yeah.
Especially when you're riding the ferry. It's the best way to diffuse. So I have had a chance to enjoy those days that were definitely meritorious of it. There was one day in particular, I was walking to lunch and all I could think was, wow, this reminds me of when I was in Austin last year because it was just that hot. I mean, that heat pounding down upon you, you felt like you were baking, even though you were walking all of 6 blocks.
Yeah, I remember those days in Tampa when I would open the front door of our work, which, by the way, was glass and, of course, had the afternoon sun beating right in through it. And you'd open the door and hear that same whoosh that you get when you open the oven when it's on broil. So, yeah, I'm hip, man. I understand. But this last couple of days for us going out and just seeing things happen has been fantastic because we've been talking about leading up to the release of the new Roger Klein CD. The fact that he was coming to town and did on Friday night and played at a new venue for the band, which was great, a place called the Old Rock House that's just a little bit south of downtown St. Louis. And it was right prior to a Cardinal game, as a matter of fact. So there were a lot of people walking by wearing red and white. But went in and saw the show. I was a little surprised that they didn't play more new stuff, but when you've got a band like that that has now, I think, 10 studio albums plus the two refreshment studio albums to draw from, it can be hard to add a lot into the set. So they played a couple of new cuts. They sounded great. And it's one of those bands that their live show is always what draws people out. You know, the CDs are great, but it's about going and seeing this band play live. And funny little thing happened afterwards, because I brought my Telecaster with me to have them sign it. And they took it on board.
Swan Song logo, by chance?
Yes, it is. The one with the Swan Song logo on the pick guard. And so I took it down and handed it to Jim Dalton, who, by the way, also plays for the Railbenders and with Johnny Hickman from Cracker in the Hickman-Dalton gang. And he took it on board the bus, and they all signed it. And as they were bringing it back out to me, the guitar tech came out and he handed it to me. And he said, by the way, Roger really likes your strap, so he's keeping it. So I got the guitar back. I got the guitar back signed, but minus the strap. So now I'm on the hook for a new one. But you know what? It'll be worth it just to see him out on stage in the pictures from upcoming shows wearing the guitar strap that came from my guitar. But last night was the weird one. So we had a great time Friday night, drank a lot of tequila and just had a blowout and watching this great band play. And last night, my lovely bride and I drove to Edwardsville, Illinois, to the Wildy Theater, which is a really, for a town the size of Edwardsville, which is not big, to have a theater that's that cool is quite an accomplishment. And we sat in the front row for a Gallagher show.
Who was it? Nola Liam. Bah, ha, 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 ha.
Yeah, right. And you know what? For a dude who I think is 71 years old, he had a great time and still smashes the shit out of watermelons and all of that. And it's crazy. But you know what? That whole theater, it was packed full of people and everybody had a blast.
Well, I'll tell you something. First and foremost, I would much rather be covered by Watermelon Gallagher than Liam Gallagher's spit. That's number one. Second of all, did they give you the obligatory rain slickers / ponchos?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, they did. And in fact, they covered a lot of the walls were covered with like torn open garbage bags, and the seats were covered the same way. So yeah, they did a good job preparing for Gallagher to do his thing. So yeah, it was, you know, again, it was a good night. And here's a little curiosity. Gallagher and I went to the same elementary school. Not at the same time, but we went to the same elementary school. So what are the odds of that happening?
Wait, he's a Buffalo guy?
No. I was in Tampa by then. Fifth grade was my first year in Tampa, and he grew up there. So, yeah, I was the last fifth grade class from that elementary school.
Nice.
Weird coincidence. Nice.
You know, the world is a tiny place, as we've learned.
Yep.
So I'm not surprised by it in the least, but I'm glad you had a good time, because, you know, I haven't been out to see any kind of shows, performances, comedy, theater in months. And I got to tell you, there's nothing really happening at the moment. You know, the only thing that's truly piqued my interest, as I was saying earlier, and I certainly can't get tickets because they're not affordable at this point, is Paul McCartney is coming in September. But
yeah,
that's September, and it's Madison Square Garden. And to be frank, I love Paul, but I just don't think his voice has it anymore to do what he does best. I just don't think he can carry it like he used to. He does a 3-hour show.
Yep.
And his voice gives. You know, if you listen to him speak, his voice is in a very quiet, hoarse, you know, kind of register now. And I wouldn't really want to spend $300 to $400 to go see a show that would at best be so-so.
Yeah.
You know, that's 3 hours invested, a lot of money and time invested. But beyond that, you know, there are smaller scale shows that look okay, but, you know, it has to be something that I think it's also, if I'm being really honest, in the last 3 to 4 years, especially since you and I have been doing this show, how many shows have I seen on a regular basis?
Right.
To the point of, okay, been there, done that.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because the smaller venues, and I know you've seen a lot of shows at the New York City Winery, but that franchise across the country has been one of the ones that's doing the most interesting stuff. And I don't know how many people the one in New York holds, but I love a venue that holds about 350 to 400. And can, you know, you can go in, and if a band comes in and rocks the joint, that's great. It's big enough to do that. But if it's a band that is a little more low key, that's okay, because there's 300 or 400 people there, and it's a very intimate kind of affair.
Correct. And the thing about it is, you go exactly as you just said, and you can go with a band, which I have seen bands there who have been absolutely phenomenal, and that's putting it very mildly. You know, give you a perfect example. The first show that I saw there was Richard Barone's 25th anniversary Cool Blue Halo show.
Yeah.
In which he had the original band come out and do the entire album and then some, which was nothing short of spectacular and near magical. I mean, there was a real emotion captured that night. And I thought, wow, what a wonderful venue. Plus, you have the added advantage and joy of being able to sit comfortably, watch the show at pretty much any vantage point in the venue, and enjoy a really wonderful glass or bottle of wine and have some great food while you're watching the show.
Yeah.
It really, you have to experience it to appreciate it. You know, having said that, I saw Taj Mahal do one of the very few completely solo acoustic appearances that he does. Now think about how old he is and how rarely he plays live.
Yeah.
And he put on a 2-hour set easily. And he had that room in absolute silence, riveted to his performance from start to finish. So you go from that one point of having a full ensemble, and we're talking about with cellos and keyboards and, you know, Garth Hudson from the band coming to join Richard Barone.
Nice.
And everyone on stage, and Tony Visconti playing bass, to having just Taj Mahal by himself. Or here's a good one, which is, this is coming up again, and they're on tour right now. Tommy Keane, completely acoustic and solo, opening up for Matthew Sweet with his band, which features Paul Chesting and Rick Menk from Velvet Crush. I mean, that's the perfect balance. You have one acoustic and a band, and both fit each other perfectly, and they fit the venue perfectly. So, you know, the thing about City Winery is, to me, it's the, I feel, especially at this age, it's the dream venue. And let's not also forget, you can go on nights when there's no shows going on and have yourself a wine and cheese tasting class. And I think that's absolutely wonderful. It's the perfect date.
Yeah. Well, right. And, you know, going back to what you said about Paul, we saw him, I think the last time we saw McCartney was 3 years ago or 4 years ago. And it was fine. It was a great show. And when he cranked it up and did Live and Let Die, it was fun to watch all the pyros and everything going off around him. But you know what? Like you, I saw Paul when he was my age, when he was 47. Well, on I think I saw him at age like 52 on Flowers in the Dirt, and a few years before that on the previous stadium tour. And that's fine. You know what? I've seen it, and that's great. But what you said about not only the money, but the fact that I'm okay with those memories, you know? That's plenty for me.
Right. Right. I mean, there are some bands that you and I have seen in their younger days that are still out there when we were in our younger days and could sustain the time spent at the show.
Yep.
You know, facts. I saw the Stones on the Tattoo U tour. That was my first time seeing them. I saw McCartney finally. And we're talking about after Wings, because even though Wings was my first concert when I was 11 years old, I was 11 years old.
Right.
I don't think that can qualify in the context of the conversation as being really cognizant beyond saying, wow, it's Paul McCartney from the Beatles with Wings, and I love both. You know, they're going to do stuff like Band on the Run.
Yeah.
You know, when I saw him next was the Flowers on the Dirt tour in 1989, I guess it was. And, you know, yeah, he was 47 years old at that point. There's a big difference between seeing McCartney when he was 34 and 47.
Yeah.
You know, start. But now it's a case of, you just don't want to have those memories sullied, quite
right.
frankly.
Right.
Look, Springsteen's not going to be able to keep going forever.
Yeah.
I've seen him several times. He's another one, puts on a great performance. I don't think I would go see The Who again, because I've seen them I saw them on the first tour with Kenny Jones in 79. I saw them do Quadrophenia, not with Entwistle, unfortunately, because I was a cheap bastard and wouldn't pay for the tickets, which is a stupid and irresponsible thing to do when they brought Quadrophenia for the first time to New York in 96.
Yeah.
Big mistake and a big regret. But I saw them do it in 2012, and I saw them on the 50th anniversary show last year, bringing the Chestnuts out, which I hadn't heard ever played live, like Pictures of Lillian, I Can See for Miles, and The Kids Are All Right.
Yeah.
And Quick One While He's Away. So when you've had your appetite finally sated in the right way, you know, why bother? Look, how many times have I seen Paul Weller over the course of 40 years in whatever incarnation? Am I going to go again this year? Probably not. You know why? Because the show that he did in 2015 was an absolute career retrospective culmination of everything. To hear Start, That's Entertainment, Town Called Malice, and Peacock Suit in the span of four songs. I couldn't ask for more than that. I don't need any more than that.
Yeah. And right now, I mean, the fact is with those venues that are, you know, 350 to 500 people, you can go out and spend $25 or probably in New York, 50 or 60 on a ticket and go sit down and or stand up if you want and have a great show. And it's the same 3 hours and it's the same good time and you're with the same friends and you still get a few hours away from the shit show that is the rest of life right now. You know, you still draw yourself out of it.
And that's the point of doing it and the beauty of doing it. You know, whether you're on the stage or you're sitting there watching.
Yep.
That's why you do it. There is that element of escapism. I don't like that word because then it becomes almost a bone of contention for a lot of people, because then other people will go, well, you're just running away from the grim reality. Right.
Yep.
You need a respite from it. You need a sanctuary from insanity. And the thing is, there are so few venues now, certainly for people in our age range, that we can actually enjoy shows in, especially if, like you and I, you just can't physically stand in the same spot for 2 or 3 hours and watch a band play like you used to be able to because you suffer from sciatica or nerve damage or whatever. You know, I mean, I've got problems where I can't stand for all that long.
Yeah, right. And still, you know, you get out of it and you get into your element. And that's the thing is it's not, I agree that escapism is a weird word to use for it, because I can't think of anything that's more real and more alive and more a part of life than being a part of a show like that, when you can still get sweated on by a guy playing a hell of a, you know, a lead guitar or whatever it is. And I mean, that is life. The artistic part of it is why we're here. And, you know, if it takes you away from what else is going on, then that's cool, because I mean, let's face it. What's more real? Going and sitting at a rock show with a bunch of your friends where there's guys actually playing music on stage, or what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now? Which one of those things is more real to you?
Well, if I may, sitting in the stands of the sports arena, waiting for the show to begin, red lights, green lights, strawberry wine, a good friend of mine follows the stars, Venus and Mars, they're all right tonight.
Well put, sir. So,
and I'm going to say that simply because that's going to lead me into our next topic, which is a Popdos article that we should give props to and point the direction at.
Hit me.
You and I talked about Paul McCartney's birthday, his 75th birthday last Sunday. And everybody at Popdos, all of us, contributed a piece, you know, called Paul's Top 75 Songs for His 75th Birthday. And Dan and DW just knocked it out of the park by putting it together. They let me have my say. And I'm just going to say, leave it like that, because I don't want to make any McCartney puns.
Yeah.
Towards this that I really despise. but I did contribute my little bits to the songs that have meant the most to me by Paul. Things like Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, Junior's Farm, naturally, which is my favorite. Mm-hmm. McCartney solo tracks, Helen Wheels, Band on the Run itself.
Yeah.
I got that one, so I'm glad to say. And God knows you and I have talked about that track in 1985. And Mrs. Vanderbilt. So I got a good portion of the Band on the Run album. Venus and Mars, Ballroom Dancing, Good Night Tonight. Everybody wrote a really great piece on each song. And again, we're talking about 75 Paul McCartney solo songs. Half of them I haven't a fucking clue where they come from because I had never heard of those songs before. Anything past Flowers in the Dirt, I don't know.
Yeah.
So there you go. And I didn't even buy that album. The last McCartney album that, as everybody knows, that I bought was Tug of War. Nevertheless, I think the one thing most humanity can agree upon is that Wonderful Christmas Time is, in fact, a scourge and a blight
yep.
on mankind. And no matter who says it, and I don't care that we did suffer through how many years of Mellow Moss, there's no excuse for Wonderful Christmas Time. And Paul should never be forgiven for that. That, along with Ebony and Ivory, are Paul's two black eyes right there.
But Paul, as you, I think you were leading into, he's not the only one that turned 75.
That is true. The other great, or I should say musical great, legend, and gifted songwriter, producer, and arranger is the one and only Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
Who also turned 75 this week. And, you know, what can we say about Brian Wilson that hasn't been said? Oh, I can tell you what we can say, because we won't put the sugar-coating nonsense that people tend to do. He was an incredibly gifted songwriter, producer, arranger. And as you and I have said during our previous shows, unlike the Beatles, he was the one-man act.
Yep.
He was the one doing it all himself, envisioning what he wanted to hear in his mind, how it was going to be mapped out. And he did that. He was coming up with things that nobody else could. And we're not just talking about Pet Sounds. We could definitely be talking about Smile, which I still think is a vastly overlooked counterfoil to what Pepper would have been. I don't care the fact that it didn't come out in 67 when it should have. You hear it now, and if it had come out, Pepper would not have happened. I
yeah.
still maintain that. I said it when I first heard about Smile back in the late 80s and started to understand the myth and the story behind it, but Brian Wilson is a gift. He is a gift to art. He is a gift to music. He seemed to be able to understand, pinpoint, and articulate, either by himself or with his varied co-writers, the inarticulation of the precipice of youthful innocence becoming more aware and suddenly becoming jaded. He knew how to take that emotion that's never really dictated properly by an actual teen on the cusp of adulthood, and he made it articulate.
Yeah, right. And there was that, the fact that most of us get to that point in life and we lose the perspective that goes along with the understanding, and he was able to distill it over and over and over again in ways that were so completely approachable. But you're right. I mean, he was, in a lot of ways, he was the singer and songwriter that McCartney was and the arranger and producer that George Martin was, all in one package.
And then add to that the sonic visionary that Phil Spector was.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So a hell of a thing, and happy birthday, Brian Wilson.
Absolutely.
Big time. And again, you're listening to Radio City. We're just kicking back here and talking it all over. And there's a couple of things going on. We mentioned a couple of times, edged into what's going on in Washington, D.C. And it just, I mean, what more can you say? You know what? I'll tell you something. There's something I'm getting a little sick of. In fact, I'm getting a lot sick of it because it's happening over and over and over again. And it's a news foible. It's something that it's a trap that they fall into because, frankly, they have zero imagination. Because we've talked before about the fact that Donald Trump is leading them into a distraction, and he's doing it on purpose. You know, anytime something comes up he doesn't want people to take a look at, he'll do something fucking crazy over here so that everybody will go, oh, look, he did something crazy. And completely, I mean, like the dogs in the movie Up, squirrel, and they'll go off and chase the squirrel that he wants them to chase. But the thing that's killing me about this is that every time he does it, the so-called news people on CNN and MSNBC and the rest of them sit there and look into the camera, and sometimes they'll have an expert on in any given field that he just did something stupid in, and they'll look at the guy and say, but why did Donald Trump do that? stop asking that question because the answer is always the same. Because he's an asshole. That's why he did that. I mean, come up with a different way to phrase it. Come up with a different way to approach the problem that we're all facing. But stop with this. Why did Donald Trump do that? Because he's an asshole.
Well, here's a continuation of that thought, because it gives them a chance to hold, I don't put any value in quote ratings, but it gives them a chance to hold on for dear life to their audiences that they've already roped in.
Yeah.
By playing this kind of game. Going along with that, there's also the chronic feeding frenzy of every single thing that Donald Trump says and does. Now,
yep.
It's kind of an obvious established thing that, and I was having this conversation with my lovely bride earlier today about it. Yes, we know he is a clown, and that's putting it mildly. Now, you have to take this all in perspective. He's from New York. We're from New York. We've lived with this fucking guy for over 30-plus years. So we're used to Donald Trump. We're used to his bombast, his obnoxiousness, his arrogance, his downright stupidity, his showmanship.
Yeah.
Call it what you want. We've dealt with it for decades. We're not fazed by it. The thing that bothers me so much, because you know what? Donald Trump, in many, many ways, and I know I'm going out on a limb saying this, but he's no different than any other president, except he's just showing you what a dick he really is.
Right.
Every other president has gone out of their way to be presidential. And I don't think people would be wringing their hands and flapping their arms and, you know, looking up to the skies with such dismay and panic and fear and all of the hyperbole that goes with it. If he acted just a little bit more sedate and presidential, then no one would give a shit. And there wouldn't be a story there,
right,
for the now extremely left, to that unhealthy left degree media that we're all now having to deal with. Fox News and their bullshit aside, there are no other media outlets, and I'm using that phrase media outlets in visible quotation marks.
Yeah.
You know, there's a feeding frenzy here going on. They need to do that, because otherwise, what's Rachel Maddow going to talk about? Fuck all. Because you know what? She's not interesting. She's got nothing besides all of her Donald Trump hoodoo. You know, and the same thing applies to what's the name of that little weasel who's on before her with the glasses?
I don't even remember. I know exactly who you're talking about. That kid who looks like he's 12.
Right. I mean, the only one worth a damn on MSNBC is Lawrence O'Donnell, and they're ready to push him out the door.
Yep.
So fuck MSNBC anyhow, you know?
Right.
I don't care. The thing is, Donald Trump is an asshole, so he does whatever he feels like doing because he knows all eyes are on him, and he loves that, of course.
Right.
I mean, he's his own favorite subject. But apart from doing the smokescreen so he'll do over here what he doesn't want you to see him doing over there, the media are going to play upon that because it gives them the opportunity to have more credentials in the witch hunt against Donald Trump.
Right.
I think they're all in cahoots with each other. I really do.
Well, yeah. And I mean, no more evidence needs to be pointed out than the fact that, you know, now we're seeing Sean Spicer in this ridiculousness of putting the daily briefings that are no longer daily briefings, the press briefings, on TV. Now they just have audio versions of them. And the reason he's doing it is because he doesn't think that Huckabee is worth looking at, and he thinks Sean Spicer's getting fat. So now Spicer's getting pushed out, and the one thing, here's an interesting note, I think, is that the one thing Donald Trump refuses to do is what people think he's going to do, to the extent that, I mean, we've heard for months now, Sean Spicer is about to be fired. We've heard for weeks now that the Attorney General, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, is about to be fired. Neither one of those things has happened. You know why? Because everybody says it's going to happen and he won't fucking do it. So now he's doing this half-assed, let's not have Sean Spicer on the briefings anymore. We'll give him some bullshit position in the communications department so that he won't fire him, because that would mean he did what the press said he was going to do.
I give him credit for having the tenacity to play the game ahead of them.
Right.
He's got them eating out of the palm of his hands.
Yeah.
And look, you know, I hate the guy. You hate the guy. But hey, as long as he keeps them guessing, it'll make for good entertainment if we can put that kind of slant on it, because otherwise it becomes so depressing and so draining. That's why, you know, I'm glad you and I chose not to go too deep into the shit that's going on this week.
Right.
Because that's not our job. This is an entertainment show. And yeah, some of it's entertaining, and yes, we need to keep people informed, but at what cost every single week? Our own sanity? Now, having said that, the one thing that did make me very gleeful this week as far as politics is concerned is the ramping up of the investigation on Bernie and Jane Sanders.
Yes.
That made me fucking smile.
Especially when they're putting Bernie Sanders out there to comment on Donald Trump and how what a crook he is. I mean, the whole thing, again, it just goes to show the entire thing is upside down and insane.
Well, the sheep-like mentality of anybody who kowtows to Sanders is what I find fascinating, as I find it equally nauseating. I mean, Sanders, as we well know factually, not just, you know, my rhetoric or those who think like I do, Sanders is not a Democrat, and yet he still beats the drum against the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party needs to return to the concept of being the rational party. And by allowing anyone that's even remotely aligned with Bernie Sanders in at the big kids table is making a grand mistake. The phrase all-inclusive has become way too much of a watershed thing right now, and it's a bullshit concept that does not exist, nor does it work. So the Democratic Party allowed Bernie Sanders and a lot of his supporters in, except they became the thing that came but wouldn't leave.
Yeah.
And I think you know that reference that I'm making right now. You know, they came in, they sat down, they helped themselves to our drinks and our snacks. Then they grabbed the channel changer and then told us how the rules were going to be played by. And it was their dictation of it. That's not how it goes. So I say that the Democratic Party needs to once again gird its loins, close and lock the fucking doors, and not allow any Sanders people in whatsoever. Let them start their own party. If they feel that they can be so much more successful than the Democrats or the Republicans, who they seem to be shilling for more than anything else.
Yeah.
Well, more power to them, quote unquote. It seems to me that, you know, after a comment that Sanders made about the Democratic brand isn't very good right now, well, Bernie, the socialist brand has never been an entity, period, in the United States. Do you know why? Because socialism is equated with commies. That's why, Bernie. So go back to the fucking USSR that you and Jane love and respect and revere so much. Eat borscht and die. I don't fucking care. But for God's sakes, know what the fuck you're talking about before you open your mouth, you drooling moron.
Eat borscht and die. I love that. That needs to be a bumper sticker. That's fantastic.
You heard it here first. And like Donald Trump, I'm copywriting it. It's mine. Mine. All mine.
Well, not
down. Go.
Not, yeah, right. Not only like Donald Trump, but also like Gene Simmons. I mean, don't forget the hook 'em horns thing.
Hey, wait a minute. I can actually make an excuse for Chaim Vitz. When he's doing the so-called hook of horns, that's the feig. That's a Hebraic symbol to ward off evil.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's true.
Remember, kiss is what do you call it? What's it when you spell something out with the letters?
It's an acronym.
It's not knights in Satan's service, because don't forget those guys are like me, disciples of Yahweh.
Yep.
It is Kaddish is so swell. That's what kiss means. For anyone who's like Paul, Gene, or myself, you know what Kaddish is, kids.
Yeah.
I'll see you sure.
Fantastic. Now, on that subject, well, since you've dragged us back into music, there's something that is on Pop Dose this week that, again, I mean, I don't know how many times you and I can sit here every week and keep singing the praises of Ken Shane, but he keeps doing great stuff and fantastic work.
You know, it's the fact that A, he's a great writer, and B, he picks shit that you and I love. This is the stuff that he grew up with and cut our teeth on.
Right.
You know, obviously, if it's going to be on Stax, Volt, Enterprise, and any one of the million sub-labels therein, you know I'm all over it like flies on an Italian bride.
Right. And this time it's Carla Thomas's B-A-B-Y in the Soul Serenade column. And, you know, I listen to it again with a new ear, because every time he pulls one of these out of the vault and shines the light on it again and says, you know what, I know you've heard this 1,000 times, here's what you missed. I go through it, and again, it's the mark of great music, because every single time, not only do I get what he's talking about, I hear something else I missed.
Well, that's the beauty of it. He's able to find those elements that we all overlook in a song that we've heard so many times, whether it touches us or not, or we've heard it too many times, whatever the case may be. You know, you have a song that's been out there now for five decades.
Yep.
And you've heard it millions of times. And it's a song you love, but you don't listen to the nuances. And when you dissect a song in the way that he presents it, you're listening, as you just said, with fresh ears. You know, so you have a new perspective on it, and you pick up on little things that you didn't hear before.
Right.
You know, it's like when I go back and I listen to Booker T and the MGs, and there you go. There's no vocals to distract. But I pick up on nuances that I missed the first time around, even on my favorite songs. You know, it's – and the beauty of a song like B.A.B.Y., when you listen to her voice, and if you've listened from the beginning when she put out things like Gee Whiz, as you move along, she's one of those singers whose voice just became smoother and more – not syrupy, but it just – it flowed in a very honeyed way.
Yes.
And she is one of those singers that as time went on and the material got stronger, her voice became even more captivating.
Baby, oh baby, I love to call you baby. Baby, oh baby, I love for you to call me baby. When you squeeze me real tight,
one thing about Carla Thomas that I love, even when she was going balls out, going toe-to-toe with Otis Redding on King and Queen, which, by the way, is being reissued, and I will get to that in a moment.
Cool.
Even when she was going balls out, there's still a sweetness and a gentility to her voice that you don't really pay attention to unless you're listening in that kind of – if you're almost listening to an anthology of her from the beginning towards the latter stage of her career. And I think B.A.B.Y. is the apex of that career, frankly.
Yeah, well, and a couple of things that I did notice in this one. And first is a musical thing, because as you mentioned, I mean, it goes to the fact that Stax didn't just turn on all of this, you know, flip all of the switches on and say, okay, go. There was a lot of attention paid to exactly a very exacting kind of sound, because on this one, instead of getting that Hammond B3, you get a lot of piano work. And if you pay attention, there's a certain kind of bounce to the piano early in this song that stands out as unique to it. But when the vocals pop in, you mentioned that honeyed kind of quality to Carla Thomas's voice. On this song in particular, her vocal is not very wetted up at all. There's very little effect, if any, on it, but they did a very cool thing, because when the vocal harmonies come in behind her, that's a little more reverby. It's still not overdone by any means, but it's got just enough added effect that it is able to build a foundation underneath her without sounding like it's an extension of her. It still allows her to stand out. It's really brilliant.
What makes it right? Because what makes it interesting is that you've got the non-treated lead vocal sounding pretty much as is.
Yep.
But background is what's being given the treatment, and that you don't get that not very frequently.
Right.
You know, that's a neat device to use, and you know, I think B.A.B.Y. may have come out right around the time that Stax had refurbished their equipment too, so that may have something to do with it. But what I was going to say is that, you know, this is, in fact, the 60th anniversary of Stax Records. So Stax, who is, quote unquote, owned, if you will, by Concord Music Group, in conjunction between Concord and Rhino, who, of course, owns the Atlantic distributed years of Stax, both music groups have teamed up to reissue the original albums from both eras on vinyl.
Oh, that's great.
So now available on Stax and Volt through Rhino would be Booker T and the MGs, Green Onions, King and Queen by Carla and Otis, Soul Men by Sam and Dave, you know, and coming later on will be, of course, Hot Buttered Soul, you know, and the Uptight soundtrack and Melting Pot, all on vinyl, Macklemore Avenue on vinyl.
Yeah.
You know, with the yellow label, with the finger snap, or the blue label with the records, you know, the record stacks of wax, either one. But yeah, the joint effort between Rhino and Concord is happening. And am I going to indulge myself in some old Stax vinyl? You better believe it.
I would be disappointed if you didn't. And there is a little bit. Oh, good. Yeah. There's a little bit of new stuff coming out, and you ran across a concept record this week, and that's, again, it's always dangerous territory. It's the same thing as we were talking about before. There are words that you can use, buzz terms, that just set people on edge, and I'm going to hand this one over to you completely because I've heard the title track off of this one and not much more, but who are we talking about? Who came up with a new concept album this week?
It's a young woman named Anna Coogan, and I will be honest, I had never heard her name before, but this was another one of those interesting submissions that I received, and I thought, okay, after reading through the press release that went along with it, I figured, let me give this a try, because, yeah, let's go back to what you just said, because it's a very important way to set this up. The words concept album have been dirty words, essentially, since the 70s.
Yeah.
Because that was the decade where we were truly besieged by them. Some were awful. Some were wonderful. You know, Yes, ELP, ELO. Look, Band on the Run is a concept album. No matter how McCartney may try and sway it otherwise, so is Venus and Mars.
Yep.
Jethro Tull were the biggest purveyors of bad concept albums. Every album by Pink Floyd after Syd Barrett left was a concept album. The point is that if you have a story that you can tell by threading them together with songs, there's nothing wrong with that. So the idea of a concept album being dirty words is a misnomer and a very unfair bias, because that automatically prejudices you against whatever the quality of the work you're about to hear may be. But we're now in the year 2017, and the singer-songwriter named Anna Coogan comes along with an album that it's, well, for lack of a better phrase, I'll go you one better than concept album, a rock opera. The last time I heard the phrase rock opera, the only word that goes through my head is Quadrophenia.
Right. Quadrophenia and Tommy. That's all I got.
Right. Or even for argument's sake, because they also build a few of them. The Kinks, you know, did soap opera and Schoolboys in Disgrace and Preservation Act 1 and Preservation Act 2. But this album by Anna Coogan, which is actually her third album, it's called The Lonely Cry of Time and Space, and it has that kind of concept album idea fully realized in the notion of you've got a lot of melody, you've got a story, and you've got a very large lyrical palette to paint from. And it's really just two people. It's herself and a gentleman named Willie B playing drums and Moog bass.
Okay.
She also has a three-octave soprano voice. So you've got her voice, you've got electric guitar, and do not for a moment think this is some kind of throwback prog rock thing either, filled with sweets. No, this is a hybrid of rock and country and pop and some kind of classical overtones when you're listening.
The rolling waves receding from the darkest star, still reeling from the dark begets the light, the brilliance of
I guess what makes this even more piquing of one's interest. Notice how that phrase has come up now 3 or 4 times during the course of this conversation alone.
Yeah, right.
Because this is the conversation about interesting stuff. It comes from music that was supposed to have been composed and accompanied a Soviet filmmaker named Yakov Protasinov in a 1929 movie of his that they were setting the score to, I guess, or a more rockin' score to, if you will.
Okay.
Called Alita, Queen of Mars, which basically likens an alien invasion to the Russian Revolution. You've got something completely different, but here you go. You know, there's a track called Follow Me, which sounds like something that would have come off of REM's Reveal or Around the Sun, you know? A track called Collateral, it sounds like it's kind of a Wicked Surf kind of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's almost that early 80s new wavy feel about it, the kind of thing that you and I would hear at late night on our college stations, you know, bands that we wouldn't have been able to recognize right off the bat because we're hearing them for the first time at that point. But later on, you know, they're bands that are kind of not dissimilar to, let's say, very, very early Depeche Mode, although not synth, you know, not synth pop, but that kind of electronic keyboards or OMD or very early first album, Psychedelic Furs. This is not an easy album by any means to listen to or absorb on the first listen. You know, it's got a lot of different styles. There's a lot of information there to try and process. And it can be a little disconcerting, but that's not in a negative way. It's just, it throws you off because you're not expecting this.
Yeah.
People don't want, I don't feel, and don't appreciate or accept that easily any more complex music. This is not the generation for that. They want quick, easy, disposable, forgettable pop because they're not going to remember it next week. This is not that.
Right. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that's in any way a knock on it. Couple of things that stood out to me. You mentioned the college radio stations. Interesting to note that as a Western New Yorker, I know very well what goes on in Ithaca. And Anna Coogan comes from Ithaca, New York, which is the home not only of Ithaca College, but of Cornell University. So it's a very literate college town, which gave us a very literate kind of album. And the other thing is that is in the same way that we were talking about how on B.A.B.Y., on the Carla Thomas song, she's almost isolated in the way that her vocals are set up in that song on purpose. With Anna Coogan, there's a whole lot more effect on it. It's a whole lot, at least in the title track of the album, The Lonely Cry of Space and Time. There's a lot more of that sort of wetted up nature of the vocals, and it works, but it doesn't bury the fact that she's a hell of a singer, that she has the kind of range you were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, and when you hear the layered vocals and her own harmonies and backgrounds,
yep,
the complexity is staggering. It really is, and at the same time, yeah, then you get the full extent of her range.
Yeah.
I think this is an album that, you know, if, I hate to say this because we live in this particular moment. If this was another time, this is one of those albums that the press would be all over because it's so different. It's intense. It has a depth to it that most things that are coming out are not going to have.
Yeah.
There's a lot of thought that goes into it. This is an album with a story, and there's a story to go along with the album that has a story. And that's what I liked about it. That's what I found so appealing about it, that I wanted to listen to it and become familiar with it. So that's why I think this is one of those records that needed to be showcased.
No doubt about it. And there's a couple of other things going on. Before we get to In Our Heads, we are at that point in the year, this odd time, as the summer reruns start to hit on TV, that what we're losing now, or at least see their season finales, because a lot of the regular, you know, popcorn TV is already gone into its season hiatus. So these last couple of weeks have been filled with the last episodes for the season of shows that are a little more interesting, shows that are not necessarily broadcast, but show up on FX or FXX. And I haven't followed all of them, but I know there's a couple that you were watching that just saw their finales. Which ones are catching your eye?
The two comedies on HBO that really have taken me by storm since their premieres are Silicon Valley, which is, of course, the creation of Mike Judge.
Yep.
And Veep, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus, which to me is possibly the most brilliant, scathing, hate-filled, hateful comedy ever broadcast and ever will be broadcast. The fact that she uses the word cunt with regularity on the air in every episode without batting an eyelash or missing a beat, you know, even I sit there going, holy shit. You know, it really, it's just, it's hysterical. It's hysterical because somewhere deep down inside all of us who watch this show, we know this is how it really is in Washington, except not as outright fall down laughing funny, because that's what this show is. At the end of the day, it is just a goddamn funny show, and the sheer brilliance and contempt-filled writing for everything that is happening in the here and now in society in general and in pop culture, as personified and taken on once again brilliantly by Mike Judge through Silicon Valley, you can't put a price on that comedic genius that's there. And the thing that what's going to be bad about it with this show coming to its season ending is TJ Miller is leaving, and he's one of the key components to this show. How it affects the show going forward, I don't know. But it's going to be interesting to see. I hope it doesn't kill it. But one of the shows that's actually coming to an end of its run, period, not just for the season, but its end, is one of the shows that I've absolutely loved from the get-go. As a child, I was always really into the American Revolutionary history period. You know, I was 10 years old or 11 years old when the Bicentennial hit.
Yeah.
So I was always immersed in it and fascinated with it, and I always loved it when we would get book reports, and just everything about that period to me was just so, there was so much to learn from, because that was the foundation of our country.
Did you collect those quarters?
Yeah, of course I did. I also had a tri-corner hat, and I was into Hector Heathcote, but that's beside the point.
Yeah.
And yeah, Bicentennial minutes religiously. I waited every night for 8:59 to roll around so that way I could see my Bicentennial minute.
Yep.
Turn, Washington's Spies, which is on AMC. It's only been for 4 seasons, but these 4 seasons have been absolutely riveting. It tells the story of a spy for the colonial army, living with his loyalist father, who is a town judge, and his wife, and being a spy and the whole Benedict Arnold caper.
Yeah.
And catching and hanging of Major John Andre, you know, key component parts to helping the war turn around for Washington. And it's just been the most dynamic. And for me, I just love the show. And the acting is spectacular, bar none. Great writing. It's history. So, of course, I love that. And I'm sad to see it go. But, of course, like all good things, a good show has to come to an end. And I think rather than dragging it out any further, they're going to end it at the right time, at that point where the revolution does indeed turn in favor of the United Colonies.
Yeah, right. And that's what you got to know when to get out. And that's a very important thing about a show like that. But going back to the HBO shows you mentioned, I always like to, you know, when I see something that I think, and whether or not they actually used it for source material or not, I don't know. But with Veep, the one that always rolls back to me is the movie In the Loop. And I have a feeling that they paid a lot of attention to that movie when they were figuring out just exactly how heinous their characters could be, and also how important it is to still have that one character who is not affected by it, who is completely good and optimistic and bright, and, you know, in the midst of all of this crap that's going on around him, is completely able to walk through it without any of it sticking to him. So that's kind of cool. And with Silicon Valley, you know, the IT crowd, the British show, the IT crowd, it didn't spin off, but I think it affected the creation and the writing of both Silicon Valley and The Big Bang Theory. And they went off in two totally different directions with it, but I am much more a fan of the way that Silicon Valley approaches that. I like The Big Bang Theory fine, but again, it's popcorn TV. I don't expect a lot out of it. Silicon Valley, I expect a lot out of, and it delivers.
Well, first of all, you have to look at the actors on Silicon Valley. I mean, all of your core cast is just, they're such gifted
and
comedians
funny,
/ comic actors. They were on, let's see, Chris Hardwick had that interim show between The Talking Dead's return and Walking Dead's return and Fear the Walking Dead. He just called it Talking because you got to have him on AMC Sunday nights at 10 o'clock no matter what.
Right.
And he had Thomas Middleditch, Martin Starr, I forget the other guy's names, Kumail, what's-his-face.
Yeah, and, who was on another short-lived TV show that was really worth watching, and unfortunately they took it off. It was based on a movie, and it was about a tech support thing going on in India. It was really funny, but it only lasted for about a half a season because it was funny and nobody watched.
And the other fellow who plays Jared, the sort of creepy assistant slash lackey to Thomas Middleditch's character. I can never remember the name of Zach Woods.
Yes.
Zach Woods. That was it. And those guys on their own merits are hysterical, especially Zach Woods. I mean, he's just so good at the deadpan, straight-faced, really creepy but deadly funny one-liners that nobody expects to hear come out of him.
Right.
And Martin Starr is good as the straight man, which you don't expect because he's so pithy, basically in everything. I mean, he's been – listen, most people still love him as Bill Howardchuck in Freaks and Geeks, but to me he'll always be Martin and Knocked Up. You guys right. are glad I'm not Jewish. Yeah, we're all so glad. Yeah, you weren't chosen for a reason.
Great TV, and the kind of thing that if you haven't gotten into it yet, this is, again, we live in the era where it doesn't matter anymore. You don't even have to wait for this stuff to come out on VHS. You can binge watch just about any damn thing you want to, which is kind of cool. So
now, before we get to In Our Heads, we do need to talk about one important thing that happened this week, and that was the expansion draft of the Las Vegas Golden Knights.
Yes.
Got my vomit bucket. Is the number one pick, the Stanley Cup winning goaltender from the Pittsburgh Penguins, Marc-Andre Fleury. That's a big fucking deal right there.
Right.
For a start. They also took James Neal of the Nashville Predators. That's a 1-2 punch right there. They're not going to be a shitty team out of the box.
No, I like the way they're doing this. But as you said, I mean, the Marc-Andre Fleury thing was an interesting move that Pittsburgh didn't protect him, but I think, I mean, they had to make a choice, and I think at this point in his career, and Marc-Andre Fleury's not that old a guy, but he's certainly, he's missed his share of games already because of health issues, and I think that that's what they were trying to avoid. I mean, I think overall, as much as Pittsburgh loves what he did and the fact that this was, you know, a Stanley Cup that he wasn't that instrumental in, and yet he's done it before. In fact, he did it last year and stood on his head to do it, too. I think it was the right move to make.
I think so, too. And let's face it, George McPhee is not a bad GM. He did a nice job rebuilding the Washington Capitals into a team of contenders.
Right.
That they'll never become now because of who's currently managing. That's their problem. But the fact that the New York Rangers made a trade that shocked and saddened me, but at the same time, I could see it because you need to be able to see this in them sending Derek Stepan and Antti Raanta, who I think was the reason why they made the playoffs and not Henrik Lundqvist in net, because like always, Lundqvist was out for an extended period of time. They shipped both of them off to the Phoenix Coyotes. Stepan was the result of a salary dump. Now, they also cut 11-year defenseman Dan Girardi 2 weeks ago, and I understand that. Girardi's play has suffered immeasurably over the last few years. A great, great team player. Nobody else would jump in front of a puck, literally, like he would, to take one for the team and let himself get hurt. But his play was just abhorrent, along with his defense partner, Mark Stahl. Mark Stahl has to go. I think the Rangers need to jettison Rick Nash, and I think they need to jettison Henrik Lundqvist because they're handcuffed by that contract of his.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I hated seeing them both go because they were both great team guys. And in the case of Stepan, there was a little bad blood from last year in the contract negotiations in which he did wind up signing a big fat contract, and they regretted it. And he wasn't productive this year, and he was a no-show in the playoffs. So I think the Rangers need to retool. And if you're going to retool, jettison the players that hinder you the most, Lundqvist and Nash.
Yeah.
Have go. They have to. You could bring back some nice packages for Lundqvist. I am sure of it. Nash is not going to bring you back much because he has proven time and time again how ineffectual he is in playoffs. And that's the biggest problem this team has had. No productivity in the playoffs. So having said that, over to you for In Our Head, because now that's out of my head and out of my system.
There you go. And there's been a lot of stuff I've been listening back to and listening to for the first time in ages this week. And yet, got something coming up a couple of days from now. And to be totally honest with you, I haven't even read the press release yet. I'm not sure why, but in my daytime job as a radio show host, a couple of days from now, I will be interviewing Ray Parker Jr., who, of course, has the significance and the distinction in rock and roll history as coming up with a Ghostbusters theme song. And then not really. The popular myth is that he was sued for it. The way it came down is that he, I think, and Huey Lewis came to a settlement over the fact that the Ghostbusters theme is effectively I Want a New Drug. And even after that settlement was reached, if I get the story right, and if I don't, write in and tell me how stupid I am, but that's fine. If I get the story right, the part of it was a non-disclosure agreement. And Huey Lewis screwed up and said, yes, we had a settlement because he ripped my song off. And then he had to pay a whole bunch of money over that as well. So however it came down, that's what's been going through my head, is that whole issue of the kinds of settlements that go on over songwriting and ripping a song off. And I mean, there are famous examples like George Harrison with He's So Fine by the Chiffons. But there are a couple of other ones that, whether or not they ever came to a lawsuit, and some of them did and some of them didn't, I've always thought were interesting notes in that songs that just sound so much like other songs. I think we even mentioned the Lady Antebellum thing and the fact that their first big hit was effectively Eye in the Sky by the Alan Parsons Project. They share an awful lot of melody and chord progression together. It's a quarter after one. I'm a little drunk and I need you now. Said I wouldn't call, but I'm lost all. But there were a couple of other ones that stood out to me as I was going down this little musical path. And the one that I'm amazed didn't lead to a lawsuit was part two of Rod Stewart's The Killing of Georgie, which is exactly Don't Let Me Down by the Beatles. Oh, Georgie, stay. John's Funeral for a Friend, which is just a minor chord version of the second half of Layla by Derek and the Dominoes. So there's a bunch of that stuff goes on in rock and roll, but those were the two that I listened to and thought, am I the only one that notices that's the same song?
Well, if that's my opening.
Have at it.
Of course, me being typical me, and you're going to know this the minute I say it, the ultimate ripoff, as far as I was concerned, was Start by The Jam, which is Taxman.
Yep. It's not important for you to know my name, nor I to know yours. If we communicate for 2 minutes only, it won't be enough. For knowing someone in this world feels as desperate as me, and what you give is what you get.
man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
And how Paul Weller managed to skirt around that one. You know, there's this 1992 or 93 documentary called Highlights and Hangups. It's, you know, it's a biography of Weller. And he sits there and very flippantly, bless his heart, says, you know, I didn't expect anyone not to notice.
Right.
You know, we've been jamming on Taxman 5 minutes before, and I thought, quick, got to get a structure together. Well, well, I mean, what else can you say to that? I mean, you know, here's poor George getting sued for, you know, my sweet Lord Doodle-Lang, Doodle-Lang.
Right.
Oh, my Lord Doodle-Lang, Doodle-Lang. I mean, fuck. And Weller gets away with it, but, you know, how does that fly? Or here's a real turd, or actually two real turds, and one of them is because I actually worked at the label when it happened.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that dreadful singer, Donna Lewis. She had that god-awful song that makes you want to at least jam an ice pick into your ear or into your eyeball called I Love You Always Forever.
Oh, yes. Oh.
See, you look like you're about to keel over. See, that's exactly what happens when I think about it. Okay. Well, she had some really fucking sorry-ass lame brain second single that was coming from her, I think, second album. And I was at Atlantic Records when we put that out. And I think the song was called I Could Be the One. And it happened to be that somebody that I worked with noticed that it sounded an awful lot like a song by another awful band, another awful song by another awful band, I should say, a terrible song from the 80s, you might remember, called Mary's Prayer, and a terrible band called Meet Danny Wilson.
Yep.
I could be your secret pleasure. I could be your well-wishing well. I could be your breath of life.
Yeah, that was another fucking boy. You didn't even try. You know, just you can sing one over the other.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and with the killing of Georgie, I think if I heard the story, and I don't, this may be rock and roll apocrypha, but I think a lot of it has to do with how much the musicians respect each other. Like if it's somebody like Huey Lewis and he's got a career and all of that, and then Ray Parker Jr. comes out of nowhere and rips his song off, who the fuck is this guy? And that's where you're going to see problems arise. But when it's Rod Stewart, and John Lennon doesn't hate Rod Stewart and understands that, yeah, the guy writes some great songs and he's put in the groundwork, then when something like The Killing of Georgie Part 2 comes out and it's, you know, and it's Don't Let Me Down, the way I heard the story is somebody eventually got around to asking John Lennon about it, and his response was, I guess the lawyers never heard it.
Lennon himself would not speak on that kind of subject anyway, because don't forget, he got sued by Chuck Berry's publishers for Come Together being a ripoff of You Can't Catch Me.
Yep.
So there's that little rub. And I think that would not serve Lennon all too well. The funny thing is, I remember going back to Ray Parker, there was an interview with him. In fact, he was told basically by the producers of Ghostbusters, you know, because they couldn't actually get Huey Lewis in the news to do Ghostbusters through I Want a New Drug.
Yeah.
Because they loved the song. They told him to rip it off. You know, and I hate to say it, but I understand when you want to have a payday.
Yep.
So, you know, there's no defending it, but I understand it. You understand it because it's called business. And, you know, when I don't even remember the last hit that Ray Parker and radio had had before he came back with I Want a New Ghostbuster. So,
yeah.
That's one of those, it's probably the most notorious of all the ripoff song cases. I then would say probably followed by My Sweet Lord. But you know what? At this stage in history, what really sounds original? I mean, hell, there are some songs. Drive by REM is, yeah, Rock On by David Essex.
Right.
You think none of us figured that out immediately?
Yep.
You're sitting there singing the words to Rock On.
I will end my comments on this with one other thought, though. As much as they ripped off everything on their first two albums, I think you and I talked about this at the time, I thought that the case against Led Zeppelin for Stairway to Heaven was bullshit.
Right.
It's not about lifting a riff. It's about lifting an entire song. And if lifting a riff is enough to get you sued, then everybody's going to sue everybody and nobody wrote anything ever. But to take those two songs and play them back to back and say, wow, those songs were exactly the same. No, they weren't.
No.
Not at all.
I'm sure you remember there was that case where Mick Jagger got sued around 86 or 87 for his song Just Another Night, his first solo hit.
Yep.
By some unknown reggae guy. And they played the original, quote, original version versus Jagger's. And I don't see the similarities.
Right.
I don't. So how you can try and say that he stole it when it sounds nothing like it, it doesn't work for me. But the thing is, I find it interesting you brought up the Zeppelin thing, because on the first, and I have to do this slowly because it gets very confusing very quickly, on the first Small Faces album, because there are two albums that the Small Faces released called Small Faces.
Yeah.
So the first album is called Small Faces. It's the Decca release when they were on Decca Records. They have the old Willie Dixon song, You Need Lovin'. And the words go, you need schooling, baby, I'm not fooling. Way, way down inside.
Yep.
Honey, you need love.
Right.
I'm going to give you my love. I'm going to give you my love. Now, it was sung with great gusto and flair by the one and only Steve Marriott. Well, as it turned out, one of the biggest fans of the Small Faces was this school kid named Robert Plant, who would come and see the band, as the story goes, right from school, even in his school uniform.
Right.
And watch the Small Faces rehearse. And by the time Robert Plant had quit the Band of Joy to join the New Yardbirds, and the New Yardbirds, of course, morphed into Led Zeppelin, and they recorded that second album, suddenly You Need Love by Willie Dixon, by way of the Small Faces, turned into Whole Lotta Love. There is absolutely no discernible way that you can't say that this ain't the same song, because right. It is.
Whether it was Willie Dixon or whether it was B.B. King, going all the way back to Travelin' Riverside Blues by the one and only Robert Johnson, they stole absolutely everything from absolutely everybody. So, yeah, I mean, that and their defense to that was, you know, a lot of those blues musicians stole from each other too. But like in the case of the Faces, they credited each other and paid each other too. Now,
so when you look at the credit on the Decca album by the Small Faces, it says
Willie Dixon. Exactly.
Now, you look at the first Led Zeppelin album and all the credit goes to, because this is the one that always kind of baffled me, Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You is, quote, traditional.
Right.
Okay, so who was the original, who really gets the songwriting credit? Because it says traditional arranged Page. Who was the writer of the song? Because that also harkens into the argument over House of the Rising Sun.
Right.
Which is on Dylan's first album. But Alan Price gets the songwriting and publishing for it.
Well, right. And with Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You, that song came to Led Zeppelin, while it is a traditional song and was an old folk song, it came to Led Zeppelin through Joan Baez. So, yeah, there is somebody that you could say, all right, if she had never recorded that song, they would never have heard that song. So, and by the way, one last thought on the Stairway to Heaven thing. If a riff is enough, think about it this way. You remember again, it was a terrible era for music, I'm sorry, but the Rod Stewart song, Some Guys Have All the Luck.
Yeah.
Remember the Ooh Oohs?
Mm-hmm.
Listen to that, and then listen to Clarence Frogman Henry's The Lonely Frog song. It's the same ooze. So if Led Zeppelin's going to get sued for that, then Rod Stewart owes Clarence Frogman Henry some money.
Pay up, Rod.
You got it. Hey, Rob Ross, it is always so much fun doing this. I can't tell you how good a time it is when we get together for these Radio City broadcasts every week. And I'm already looking forward to the next one, man. Thanks a lot for doing this.
Hey, like always, it's a pleasure and a joy. And, you know, we got to do a special one coming up soon because we're going on 4 years of working together. And it's been nothing short of an absolute joy and a blast. And, you know, since I can't go back to Hoboken because it would break my heart to do so, to see Maxwell's, I guess we'll just have to relive it on the fourth anniversary show of us working together, even though this is not that show that shall not be named, since that was another incarnation.
Yep.
And by the time we get to our fourth anniversary show, I should have my microphone working where I'll sound like a decent human being instead of sounding like I'm on a call.
You got it, my brother. Well, listen, thanks a lot. We'll talk again next week. And in the meantime, as we tell you each and every time we do one of these, there's all kinds of material elsewhere on popdose.com and always something to click on to listen to or watch. So go read some of the words on the page by the other folks who put this website together. It's well worth your time. And we'll talk to you again next week.